one of the biggest surprises that I took really to heart in the book was getting to know first, where we're so wired. I mean, we're completely wired for the opposite. For example, on a recruiting call, if I call a typical agent, you know, who doesn't know who I am, I might say, "Hey, you know, Chris, this is Alex Vidal with Related ISG, blah, blah, blah. How are you doing today? By the way, I see you're a great agent. I was calling to see if you would be interested in learning more about my company." And the typical answer is, "No, I'm happy where I'm at." It's a 30-second call.
Right.
I read your book. I sit down with my leadership team and I say, "Guys, I want to try something different. Just hang out. I'm going to put it on speaker." So I call Chris, and now Chris answers the phone and I say, "Hey, Chris, this is Alex Vidal with Related ISG International Realty. How you doing today?" "Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?" I'm like, "Oh man, I'm doing great. I already know you're a great agent. Just the fact that you even picked up your phone to begin with." And they start laughing, you know, because in realtors in South Florida never answer their phone. So then I follow up and go, "Let me ask you a question. Do you want to make less money this year than you did last year?" And they say, "No." I'm like, "No, no, of course not. Of course I want to make more money this year than I did last year." "Oh, it sounds like you want to make this your best year ever." "I do." "Well, that's why I was calling. I want to show you how my brokerage can help make that happen for you." And I got the no right away. And then you got the no out of the way. And I followed it up with, you know, the mirroring and the labeling and all that. And it was very interesting. My average recruiting call went from 30 seconds to 10 minutes.
Wow.
And just using that opening line, and I don't care, I'll share it with my competitors. I really, it doesn't really bother me. They're just spewing out information, literally using the mirroring and the labeling. What is it about people's need to want to say no? And what are the benefits of getting that no out of the way first?
Yeah, you know, we're conditioned. There's some conditioning out there that we got to recognize. It's just true. So we've gotten conditioned that every time we say yes, somebody's trying to lead us into a trap. Somebody's trying to get us to say yes. You know, the momentum selling says each yes is a tie down. A tie down takes away our autonomy, a basic human driver of what we are as human beings. Not what we are as males or females, not what we are as Westerners, as human beings. And this is about human wiring. You can't point to a civilization in the history of mankind that was content as slaves. It's driven us since we crawled out of the swamps. So these tie downs take away our autonomy and immediately begin to diminish rapport as we take away somebody's autonomy. And so we've been conditioned that if somebody's trying to get us to say yes, we're under attack. We've also conditioned ourselves is when we say no, we've just protected ourselves. We've just done something to preserve our autonomy. We're safer. Mm-hmm. Every time we say no, which is why so many people's default answer is no, not because they thought it through, but they've conditioned themselves, which means they feel safe when they say no. There's a neurochemical response. Sure. The chemicals that you feel when you say no make you feel safe and secure. Consequently, you're more willing to listen. Your guard's not up. You've protected yourself. So you start out with that question right away where somebody says no, then they've just gotten a hit of all the chemicals that make them feel safe. And now they're willing to talk to you. And then your follow-on moves are all designed to make them feel heard, like you're interacting with them instead of against them. I mean, it sounds like you like to make more money. That was based on their response. You instantly prepare yourself to go into a collaborative conversation. Again, they're not threatened. They're not being attacked. They're not under siege. And now I'm not the least bit surprised that you're going from 30-second calls to 10-minute calls, because as soon as you preserve the other side's autonomy, now they can talk to you candidly. Plus, you're different than all the other bozos out there that are trying to get them to say yes.
That's it. And you know, the typical answer is, "Well, I'm happy where I'm at." "Oh, it sounds like they take really good care of you." "Yeah, they do." "Awesome. What is it that they take, you know, maybe I can learn something about, I can do in my company. What is it that they do to take care of you?" And then you start finding all these holes and then the wall just keeps coming down. We had a conversion rate of 75% from calls to appointments. It was unbelievable. And that's why I believe so much in the book. I read a lot of books, but very few make a direct, immediate impact the way yours did.
Just curious, all right, so you got to a conversion rate of 75%. What roughly were you doing before that?
Oh, probably we would get maybe one out of maybe every six 7-8 calls, maybe we'd get an appointment.
Wow.
And then those appointments had to show up. The fact was, not only were we at a 75% conversion rate, but the bond that we had created with those people during that phone call was so good that they actually showed up for the appointment versus, and it, I don't even have questions about the yeses, but we, you know, you talk about in your book, the three types of yeses that we get, that we typically get. And so by spending 10 minutes on the phone with them, we actually get the approval action-based yes that moves the ball forward, not just something to get us off the phone.
Interesting.
The phases of no, or what we like to refer to, as you see down there in the bottom right, letting no out slowly. We've all seen How Am I Supposed to Do That in the book. We do not explicitly lay out what the phases of no are in the book, partially because this wasn't a fully explored skill from all angles when the book was written, right? We had all this great content. We wanted to get it out to the world, and that's what we had. We continued to develop and grow, just like everybody should. And so one of the biggest things we found from people that have read the book is there are varying degrees of outcomes to the response, how am I supposed to do that? For some of you, maybe you're still batting 1,000. Every time you say, how am I supposed to do that? You get exactly what you want. They fix it and you move forward. I'm sure in some cases on the other extreme, you've maybe never had the success you thought you'd have with how am I supposed to do that? And you've had varying responses, including they tell you how to do it. Well, how am I supposed to do that? Well, this is how you do it. You get these people together and you line them up in this way and you do these things and it should take you about a week to accomplish, right? They actually give you an answer on how are we supposed to do that. And now you feel stuck. And so, or you're somewhere in the middle, right? You're either on the ends or you're somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. You've already figured this out as we've worked our way through today. Why is that? Because in the book, it doesn't talk about using an accusations audit to deliver your ask. How am I supposed to do that? Is not only an ask, it's an assertive ask. And so it's even more paramount that an accusations audit come before it. In the book, accusations audits were used by Chris before he dropped this line in at the car dealership with the dealer. We just didn't call out the skill specifically. But if you remember the story, he would constantly say things like, you've been so generous. I can't believe how much work you've put into this. You spent a bunch of time with me today. I really appreciate all the effort and time you've given me. I can't believe, you know, and the car is worth more than what I'm asking for. It's probably worth more than what you guys listed it at. How am I supposed to do that? That was the accusations audit. Generosity and time don't seem like negatives. Why does that apply in this case? Because it's based on their perspective. And the negative that we are attacking is if we don't recognize how generous they've been, they're immediately going to start to remove themselves because you have the audacity not to even see how much time I put into this. And that's when it becomes a negative. Their perspective, how can you not see how hard I'm working to get this done? I would consider myself generous to even still be entertaining this interaction with you. And so calling them generous in the accusations audit is actually directly resulting in what the negative that exists is causing, what friction is there. And so another part of this that you should be well aware of, and another reason we've had varying degrees of success across the board, this is not a sequential move game. How am I supposed to do that should be delivered at least twice, if not three times, before you move forward in the conversation. Why is that? Well, first of all, since it's a question, it's also a thought pattern interrupt. And if they got momentum going, angry or not, doesn't matter, but if they got mental momentum, right, moving forward, chances are the first time you throw a thought pattern interrupt at them, they're not going to be able to process it. Like it literally just won't penetrate the cranium because the wheels are spinning. And so part of the reason to go back to it again is because they're going to hear it differently the second time after the wheels have started to slow down. And then you may need to go three, because when they finally do hear it and they give you an answer, it might be, well, because you got to do this, because I said so. And you throw it at them a third time to really and emphatically put your foot down on the implication of, that is not going to work for me. You got to come up with a different, better solution if we're going to continue forward. And that's the intention behind everything that comes on the third delivery without having to actually verbalize it. And then you move through the list. After you've done it three times, then your fourth move is, I'm sorry, I just don't know how I can do that. Fifth is, that's not going to work for me. And finally, your sixth is the flat out no. I will tell you, up to this point, we don't actually know anyone that got all the way to no. Doesn't mean it can't happen. Over the past 12 years, it hasn't yet. But, you know, it's obviously a possibility. And so that's how you sequence it out. Again, tone is going to be important every time you deliver. Emphasis on the I, and how am I supposed to do that, is one way to deliver it. Late night FM DJ, use an accusations audit before every single delivery. If you put any one of these skills out there completely naked, the chances that it's going to backfire on you in the moment is that much higher.
I'm into long-term prosperous relationships, positive sum games. And if you are not, then even if you throw a lot of money on the table, it's still going to be painful.
So are there other tricks that you would employ apart from disarming me with seems like, looks like, feels like? What are the other tricks to conversation? You mentioned Oprah at the beginning. What does Oprah Winfrey do in her interviews that make her so successful? I remember a long, long time ago, one of my psychology teachers explained to me the power of mirroring, just repeating what someone says. Yeah. I don't know whether, is that part of the negotiator's handbook?
It can be. You know, you gave me two different questions. What does Oprah do, and what's part of the negotiator's handbook? So I'm going to go to what Oprah does first.
Does that make me a bad negotiator right there?
No, it means
I listen. It seems like you think it does.
Ooh, there's a mislabel. No. No, not at all.
No?
Getting people to say no is a good thing. First of all, don't be scared of no. But here's a real key to what Oprah
Sorry,
does.
I can't let you move on from why no is a good... I can't let you move on because we were all taught no is a bad thing. Why is no a good thing?
The biggest turning point in every negotiator's life is coming to grips with what no really is. That may have been the single biggest turning point for me. Because like everybody else, getting to yes, you want to hear yes. Yes is the end of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I mean, you know, we're almost hypnotized to believe that yes, when you hear yes, the heavens part, the angels sing, the birds chirp, you know, you people bring you food, they're fanning you, you know, everything, right? Hearing it. But so the turning point for me was, I read a book called Start With No, Jim Camp, 2002. I'm passing a book in an airport bookstore, and I literally do a double take. I'm like, what? Start with no? You're supposed to get yes. How do you start with no? And Camp was like, in order to free people up, just tell them it's okay to say no. He called it the right to veto. And his negotiation style was to start out with by saying, like, look, you can say no to me at any time. I just want you to know I'm not here to try to back you into the corner. Yes. Anytime you want, say no, I'll get up and move away. I'll be gone. And his approach was that preserves the other person's autonomy. And he literally says in his book, people will die for their autonomy. And I'm reading it, and I'm going like, no kidding. That's why we have hostage negotiators in the first place. We had SWAT teams. We didn't have negotiators. We just surround their house and tell them to come out or get killed, which was taking away their autonomy. And law enforcement globally were killing people who would rather die than give up their autonomy. They were caught, you know, they come out guns blazing, but after a while we'd be like, all right, so we know this dude came out shooting at us, but he was just some poor slob that had too much to drink and got upset and mad at his wife, and she called him names and ran out. Did this guy deserve to die because he drank too much and he was unhappy? Yeah, you know, it was a legally justified killing. But morally, is there a better way to approach this? And we thought, what if we pay somebody to maybe ask them nice? And that was kind of how it was all born.
Is there something about saying no as well? Like, I'm thinking about a recent negotiation I had with my 11-year-old son, Chris, and he was asking me about something that I felt uncomfortable with. Right. And when I said no to him, when his request, it gave me a sense of safety. And then I felt like we could negotiate from there on. We could find a middle ground.
So essentially what you're going to do when you're doing no-oriented questions is you're going to make no work for you. Okay, you're going to get them to give you a yes, but they're actually going to be able to say no. Yes, when you're going for a yes from somebody and you're constantly trying to get them to say yes, you're taking away their autonomy. And when someone says yes, sometimes it seems like a trap to them. It also seems like no matter what the question is, if they say yes, it's some kind of a commitment that they might not be ready to get into. So instead, ask them a question that they can answer no to, but it actually means yes to you, because saying no makes people feel protected, makes them feel safe, makes them feel like they still have all their cards hidden, and they just feel better about it. So if you put that question in a way that allows them to be negative, it works out better for you. Also, when you're constantly asking questions that you want a yes answer to, you look like that demanding mother who says, did you clean your room? Did you do the dishes? Did you do this? Did you make your bed? Because, you know, everyone heard that from mom growing up, right? Yeah. And you're like, yes, 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 yes. And it's just like so annoying. So no one wants to be equated to the demanding mom. So instead, you can say, would it be impossible for you to make a copy of this for me? And they're going to want to say no, because maybe they don't want to make the copy. I don't know, but they're going to say no. But is it going to mean no? It's going to mean yes to you because of the way you phrase the question. So it's really kind of magical how this works. Essentially, you are demonstrating concern for what the impact that ask is going to have on that person. Because, you know, when you're asking someone to go run an errand for you, would it be impossible for you to run to the store and get this for me? Okay, you're saying, yeah, by my tone of voice, I'm letting you know that I know this might be inconvenient for you, but would it be impossible for you to just do this for me? Proper tone is important. Davey, take the next one. Sets up the powerful feeling of graciousness. You're better at this one than I am.
because you can use there are a few phrases that are really go-to for no-oriented questions. So would it be impossible to, would it be ridiculous? Would it be out of the question? Like those are three really good go-tos. If you want to make it a little bit more specific, so for example, say that you have to move a meeting, like this happens to me a lot, right? Then you say, would it throw off your whole, like, I know you're already busy, would it throw off your whole schedule if we moved this meeting? So it's almost this opportunity again to express understanding, to express like, hey, I know you're busy, this might throw everything off. So you can even phrase the question in that way, right? Or something I really like to do is, would it be really difficult to, or would it be bothersome to? So like you can use whatever you think, like, well, they might feel like this is annoying, or they might feel like this is going to be really problematic for them. And so then you say that in that no-oriented question. It's almost like a way that you can kind of address whatever it is that they're going to feel within the no-oriented question, essentially. So it makes it feel kind of gracious because you've thought about this. You've thought about how is this going to impact you? Instead of just making an ask and making sure they do it, you're thinking about, okay, this is going to impact this person in this way. Mm-hmm. And you express that, and then they're even more likely to want to do what you're asking, essentially.
It also, depending on the kind of question that you're asking, and some of the things that Davey was just saying kind of fall under this, makes the other side feel like the decision to do the action was theirs. So if you, and you can double whammy him with an accusations audit, you may think I'm being so irresponsible with my time and my schedule. Would it be impossible, or would it put you in a bad position if we could move the meeting to 3 o'clock? And then they're going to say, oh, no, it's okay. We can move the meeting. It's going to feel like the decision was theirs because you basically asked that question in a way that it feels like they can decide whether or not they can make the movement. But because it was kind of geared at a no-oriented question, it makes them feel like they were nice enough to take that action for you and it was their decision.
Yeah, okay, like so the ball was in their court. They're doing this for you.
Yes.
And it lets them feel like they're being nice.
Exactly. And that is huge when you're talking about where you stand psychologically with somebody, because the more you make somebody feel like they are in control, the better they feel, even when they're not in control, because you know you're asking the questions in such a way that you are literally in control, but you're letting them feel like they have the control. So that does do something for people in their brains. So it's just something to really keep, you know, in the forefront of your mind when you're about to ask someone a yes question that you want a yes to. Take 2 seconds to frame it so that they can say no, but still mean yes to you.
Yeah, exactly. Then they feel like they're the ones that they're maintaining power, essentially.
Yes, because no is a powerful thing to be able to say to someone.
Let's start with talking about mastering the no. This is letting them hear no, letting them feel no, without actually saying the words no. And so for your best results, it's going to be tactical empathy on the front end, and then however you're going to say no. And we'll talk about the 4 phases of no in a later session. But you're letting them hear it, letting them feel it without you actually saying it. Ned Colletti used to manage the Dodgers back in the day. And he was famous for saying, I like to let out no a little bit at a time. And so we're going to talk about ways to actually push back against the other side without cornering themselves and without cornering you. Mastering their weaknesses, their weaknesses. Where do you think the cutthroat's weakness lies?
Not having control.
That's one of them. They need to feel like they're in control. The assertive, the cutthroat negotiators, are looked upon as some of the most difficult people to deal with in a difficult conversation and negotiation. From my perspective, they're the easiest because they want to feel like they're in control. And they want to feel like they got the best deal that they could. The operative word in both of those is feel. Yeah, Chris tells a story all the time about being in the international kidnapping market and the powers that be wanting to know when are they going to release the kidnapped victim. And Chris's standard response was when they feel like they've gotten everything that they could, when they feel like they got the best price possible. Doesn't mean that they actually end up with the best price possible. They just need to feel like they did. And so we're talking about feelings. And how stupid is that when you're talking about international kidnappers and terrorists? We're talking about how they feel. And so our job is to make them feel in control as early as possible, using deference, using subordination. You may even want to say, you know, it's clear that you've got the upper hand here. It's clear that you're in control here. They'll eat it up. They'll eat it up. You try it one time when you go into an area, a space in your organization where you don't have the same cachet as you do in your own, but you bring to the table a special knowledge or skill or ability that's going to help this other space improve their ability to do their job. And when you come in there, you're viewed as an interloper, you're viewed as an outsider. And so as a result, you'll likely get pushback for any idea, any suggestion that you make, because it's not your area and you're encroaching. And the sooner you recognize that and defer to that, the more cooperation and non-obligatory buy-in you'll get from the other side.
I don't even bother with the word yes. And when we were working on the book, one of the guys that I was working with, he said, "Hey, how'd you get the, as a hostage negotiator, how'd you get kidnappers to say yes?" Only question I can remember being thoroughly stumped by, because I'd never really thought about it that hard at that time. And I said, "No, we never did. It's a useless word. So we didn't even bother with it." So some of you are sitting there thinking right now, like, "Okay, fine. Now what do you want me to do?" Because that's all I do. And you know what? I close deals that way, too. You can't tell me that I don't close deals getting people to say yes. Now, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying your batting average isn't anywhere close to what it should be. You're batting 125 when you should be batting 350 for you baseball players. Yeah, stick to 125. You want to stay there? Because this is what it looks like, and this is why it fails. Would you like to have a more efficient system? Would you like to have more customers? Would you like to have more free time? Buy my product. Now, this is, maybe there was a point in time when this was a good idea. Maybe. But the swampland timeshare salesman, the coupon book, the $50,000 coupon book salesman has already battered them so hard that they're battered by yes. You guys know anecdotally what happens if you come across a battered child and you try to hug them. They still flinch and jump back from you. But wait a minute, I was trying to give them a hug. I'm a good guy. I meant well. I wasn't trying to trap them. I was trying to have integrity. It doesn't matter. They're battered. Everybody's battered by yes. You got to stop this. You got to stop it. Okay, fine. You convinced me. Now what?
Hey, it's Chris Voss, CEO of the Black Swan Group. Today I'm going to discuss the top four no-oriented questions. You'll learn how to use them so that you can gain the upper hand in any negotiation. Stay tuned until the end of the video, and be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Now, let's get started. Number one, is now a bad time to talk? Look, this is a great way to get started on relearning a lot of your communication skills into the Black Swan Method. And one of the greatest and simplest ways is to start with no-oriented questions in place of a question you ask all the time. And a question you ask all the time is, have you got a few minutes to talk? How many phone calls, how many interactions have you started out with, have you got a few minutes to talk? That's a yes-oriented question. We hate yes, we love no. And this is how you begin to make the transition and begin to take power. And I'll explain to you in a little while how just a switch from yes to no can probably increase your close rate at least 23%. So instead of, have you got a few minutes to talk, is now a bad time to talk. Now, there are only two answers to this question. This happens all the time. You only are going to get one of two answers. A person is either going to say, no, it's never a bad time to talk. What do you got? And you've got their complete attention, which is what you were after to begin with. Or they're going to say, yeah, it is a bad time to talk, but I can talk Tuesday at 2. If it is a bad time to talk, they always give a great time to schedule a call where, again, you've got their undivided attention. Now, what's the problem with, have you got a few minutes to talk? Ask yourself, what do you feel when somebody asks you, have you got a few minutes to talk? All these things go through your mind. What do you want to talk about? Do I want to talk to you? How long is a few minutes? The point is, and when all these things are going through someone's mind, they're not listening to you.
So when someone says, no, it's never a bad time to talk to you, they've completely cleared their mind and they're prepared to talk to you. Now, what if they just say yes and they don't give you a good time to talk? I've seen people ask this on LinkedIn all the time. This is insane. How stupid is that? Do you really want to talk with someone when they just told you it's a bad time to talk? You really want to keep them on the phone with you while they just said they don't want to talk and it is a bad time to talk? That sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Speaking of ridiculous, number two, no-oriented question. Is it a ridiculous idea? Now, we ask this instead of, is it a good idea? We ask this instead of, would you like to? Is it a ridiculous idea? This is a question I use with Jack Welch, very generous man based on my interaction with him, to get him to agree to come and speak at the negotiation course I was teaching at the University of Southern California at the time. I go to a book signing. There are a long line of people in line trying to get Jack Welch to sign their book. Jack and Susie Welch are out on a book tour on their most recent book at the time, The Real Life MBA. They're signing books in LA. I want to go and get Jack to speak at the class. They're hustling people through the line. They're doing everything they can to keep you from talking to Jack while you go through the line for a whole variety of reasons. You've got maybe 30 seconds from the moment that you walk up to the moment they want you to walk away. This is not time to engage in a negotiation or a conversation. I walk up to Jack Welch. He has no idea who I am. I'm just another person at the book signing. And I say, is it a ridiculous idea for you to come and speak at the negotiation course that I teach at USC? Now he looks up and to the left and he gets this hideous look on his face. And he looks furious. And he just freezes with this look on his face. I get horrified. I'm afraid I've made him so angry he's had a stroke or something. He's getting ready to die. Finally, he looks down at me and says, this is my personal assistant's name. This is a Twitter account that we use to communicate with her. I will call her and tell her who you are. I think we're going to be in Los Angeles in the fall. If we are, we'll come in and speak at your course. This is one of the great things that a no-oriented question does. It triggers follow-on thought. While Jack was looking up and to the left, he was thinking through implementation details before he responded to me. This is one of the crazy things, the crazy advantages of no-oriented questions. Number three, are you against? We use this instead of, are you in favor of? Would you like to do? Does this sound like a good idea? Are you against? And then name whatever it is. One of the times this worked great was we were teaching the Black Swan team, myself and Brandon, we were teaching a Black Swan method to some people in the healthcare industry. One of the women in the room who worked on behalf of this healthcare company had been trying to get a head nurse in a particular hospital to implement a program. The head nurse had been adamantly against it. She was always saying no, 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 no. This is one of the things that's interesting. People get into the mode of always saying no, and it's their automatic response. This is why no-oriented questions works. She wanted to test the idea to see if we could get no-oriented questions to work. She walks out of the room. She calls the head nurse and says, are you against? And then asked her to implement the program that she'd been trying to get the head nurse to say yes to for weeks. When she simply went from a yes response to a no response, are you against? The head nurse said, no, I'm not against it. And they made the agreement on the spot. She turned around and walked back into the room and said, you guys are not going to believe what just happened. She went out and got an agreement on the spot with a no that she hadn't been able to get previously for weeks. Now, let's do something crazy. Let's put the two of these things together. You'll find that people suffer, all human beings suffer, from something known as decision fatigue. They can only make so many decisions in a given day. and they're beginning to run out of energy for decision making sometime after lunch in the afternoon, and they begin to get drained. So a couple of years ago, I had an intern that only asked me what and how questions because he was horrified at doing something wrong all the time. He was just afraid to make a mistake. And he'd ask me what to do or how to do something in the middle of the afternoon. And I'd be like, I don't know, leave me alone. And finally, I told him, anytime after 1 o'clock on any given day, don't ask me any questions unless the answer is no, and I'll be able to think it through. And then he could ask me at the end of the day, look, I'm going to do this. Do you want me to do this? And I'd be like, no, do this. And I'd give him an answer. I could give him direct guidance straight away. People can answer no-oriented questions even when they're decision fatigued. Now, how can I prove this to you? Several years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting Robert Herjavec. Robert Herjavec, very generous guy. Got introduced via an email, mutual friend. We go to lunch, steakhouse in LA. He happened to have an office just down the street from where I was living at the time. And it was my favorite kind of lunch. Free, he paid. Number one indicator of how generous a guy he is. Number two, I got 90 minutes with him. Second indicator of how generous a guy was and is. So at the time, we're getting ready to teach the Black Swan Method at a live training session in New York. I offer him a free ticket. Now, I don't expect him to come. I think he's going to send one of his top guys. I want them learning the Black Swan Method. He looks back at me and says, how many can we buy? Another indicator of a generous guy. So we're going back and forth with his team over how many tickets they're going to buy. Brandon Voss, the president of the Black Swan Group, calls me on the phone and says, we can't get a commitment out of Herjavec's people, and we're getting ready to sell the event out. Our tickets are expensive, and they sell out because the Black Swan Method is that good. People want the value. Brandon says to me, if you don't get Herjavec to commit to the tickets now, then we're going to be sold out by tomorrow morning. He's not going to get any, and I'm going to sell the free ticket that you promised him. Now, I'm in Los Angeles at the time. Brandon's on the East Coast, which means he's got a three-hour advantage, or we've got a three-hour disadvantage in Los Angeles, and it is 4:30 in the afternoon. Now, one of the additional problems is we got to get this executed because by the time the business day starts in L.A., it's 3 hours into the business day on the East Coast. It's almost lunchtime. I got to execute this now. I send an email to Robert Herjavec at 5:03 in the afternoon. Remember the decision fatigue issues? When was the last time you tried to get an answer out of somebody after 5 o'clock at night? I send him a two-line email. Number one, is it a ridiculous idea for you to commit to three tickets to the event now? Second line, are you against paying for them before the business day starts in New York tomorrow? That email goes out at 5:03. I get a response at 5:04. No. We're prepared to commit to three tickets now. No, it's not a problem. My assistant will get back to you within the hour and we will pay for the tickets. The tickets are paid for and it's all wrapped up at 5:23 in the afternoon. From 5:03 to 5:23. No oriented questions to close the deal. Number four, which is also the number one way to restart communications. Have you given up on X and then name whatever it is? Send that out in a one-line email with this in the subject. And if you put anything in the body, put only that in the body. Send it out as a text message by itself, word for word. This is one of these things in the Black Swan Method that you have to execute word for word. I once had a woman say, you know, I tried that have you given up line and it didn't work. And I said, all right, well, really? Okay, possible. Tell me word for word what you said. And she said, well, you know, I thought the way you worded it was a little harsh. So instead of saying, have you given up on, I said, should we give up on having lunch to discuss the project? And I thought to myself, I wouldn't answer that either. Here's a side note. In your choice of pronouns, you'll notice that a lot of times people default and say we when they mean you. A couple of years ago, I was talking with Brandon about a project that wasn't getting done. And I called him on the phone. I said, look, we got a problem. And he said, you know, stop interrupting me with that we stuff. You mean I got a problem. Let's be honest. Change your we's to you when you mean you. The other side will actually appreciate it. But this is a common problem that people do in their pronouns. Be really careful. If you mean you, say it. People know the disguised we and they're not fooled by it. It actually makes them feel very uneasy. Have you given up on? Now, context is important. This has to be something that's ongoing. I got to tell you, the Black Swan Group, I get emails all the time. First time email, somebody says, have you given up on doing business with me? Well, since I never started, I couldn't have given up. So I take this as a sign of a manipulative person. Already I don't want to do business with them. Many times, just to make the point, I'll fire back, yes. Because it was so out of context. So this is context driven. This has to be something that they have been working on for a while. Now we really got onto this line in a Black Swan team a number of years ago when we were teaching negotiation at Georgetown, and one of the students in a class, and I mentioned this in the book, Never Split the Difference, brilliant student at Georgetown. He's working on a Republican fundraising committee. This was several elections back. I think it was the second Obama election. And they're doing dialing for dollars at night. What's dialing for dollars at night? They call people on the phone. They ask them three yes-oriented questions. Supposed to be tied down, supposed to be the yes momentum, then you ask for the money. Theoretically, the way this nonsensical theory works is that people got to say yes to the last question. Everybody's been hustled and conned by this. Believe me, they don't have to say yes to the last question. The idea that each yes is a micro agreement or a tie down is nonsense. However, it's really common in the real world, and a lot of people do this because much of the real world is monkey see, monkey do, and this is caught on. Well, he goes in that night, and he changes the yes-oriented questions to no-oriented questions. And the first question was, of course, would you like to take the White House back in November? So he changes it to the no-oriented question, have you given up on taking the White House back in November? They ran the no-oriented script side by side to the yes-oriented script that night in the morning. They had a 23% higher success rate with the no-oriented script, 23%. What happened with the committee that he was working on? They came in that morning and they looked at the results and they said, don't ever do that again. That was a fluke. That's not the way we do things around here. Have you given up on? It's got to be driven by something that someone has been working on. Here's something else that's important for you to remember in this. If they've gone silent on you, if they're ghosting you, and this is the response for when someone has gone silent on you, when they're ghosting you, this one line will restart your communication. It will work and it is a one-shot reset. What's important to remember? Remember this phrase. The system you're employing is perfectly designed to give you the outcome that you've achieved. Your communication system with the person who's ghosting you is perfectly designed to get them to ghost you. You cannot go back to the same approach that you had that led up to them going silent on you, them ghosting you. You cannot. I gave this advice one time to a woman who was selling an investment fund, shares in an investment fund. She was having trouble getting a man to get back to her that she wanted to make the investment. And I said, look, send this out, send this text out, he'll respond. She's like, fine, you know, he's not getting back to me, but I got nothing to lose, so I'll go ahead and try it anyway. The guy responded, and she went right back into her sales pitch that led him to ghost her in the first place. And that was the last time she ever heard from him. So don't go back to the communication system that you were using. Now, why did they ghost you? Because the communication was ineffective. People continue to communicate if it's effective, if it's working for them, if it's moving their agenda, if it's helping them get to their goals. So one of two things has happened in the midst of this communication. Number one, they've lost all power and influence on their side of the table. They're embarrassed to tell you about it. You have to take that into consideration. Number two, you're not listening. You're pitching, you're selling. If you were listening to them, they'd still be in touch with you. If you were listening to them, you'd have heard the hints, you'd have perceived the signals that they were sending out to you about whatever the problems were, that they're losing power and influence in their company on their side of the table, or that you're not listening. You have to take this into account before you restart the communication. The most likely thing for you to do after you've restarted the communication is to summarize the situation from their perspective. You want to reestablish productive communication. You want to establish rapport. You want to get them bonded back to you to continue to find out what's going on. You got to get a that's right out of them. Do a great summary. Summarize the communication from their perspective. Summarize the negatives. Stay away from your sales pitch. Stay away from your value proposition. Get a that's right out of them, and you will have fully reset the communication.
At some point in their development, all negotiators have to come to grips with no. When you come to realize the real psychological dynamic behind it, you'll love the word. It's not just that you lose your fear of it, but that you can come to learn what it does for you and how you can build deals out of it. Yes and maybe are often worthless, but no always alters the conversation. Talk us through that.
Yeah, I think I first came across this idea. Jim Camp wrote a book in 2002 called Start With No. And I remember seeing that on a bookshelf and like doing a double take on like, start with no. I thought we were supposed to get the yes. Like, yes was a magic word. And he had discovered inadvertently that if you just told people it was okay to say no, that they were more likely to agree. He's right up front, he called it the right to veto, and he'd say, you know, I just want you to know before we get into this, you can say no at any time. You say no to me anytime, and I'll go away. And he made more deals. So accidentally, one of my hostage negotiators in Pittsburgh tells me, she says, because I'm making everybody read this book. Did I do this? Now, she was going to be removed from the negotiation team in Pittsburgh, because her boss was jealous of how much the police department loved her. So she finds out she's going to get removed, which is going to hurt the office's relationship with the police department. But this guy doesn't care because he's jealous. She sits down with him and she says, do you want the FBI to be embarrassed? Now, I remember when she first told me that, I remember thinking through at the moment, like, I would never have had the guts to say that. Like, that sounds so manipulative. I imagine this guy just bursting into flames on the spot. But instead, this guy relaxes. He leans back in his chair. He steeples with his hands, like it's what people do when they feel really good about themselves. And he goes, no. She says, what do you want me to do? And he says, well, you know, stop letting this stuff interfere with your investigations now. Go back to work. So he calls her in to fire her from the team. She walks out, no problem. So I'm like, there's something here. And then I start thinking about other conversations I've had.
lieutenant on a police department that I thought got in his guy's way a lot because he was overmanaged him. I remember him saying to me once, you know, a lieutenant's job is to say no. And I thought, no, it's not. Lieutenant's a leader. A leader's job is to encourage people, not to say no. So why is he saying this? It makes him feel good to say no. It makes him feel safe. It makes him feel protected. And we start experimenting with, instead of letting people say no, what happens if you actually get them to say no? Like, how does that change feelings, the way they react? And it makes such a massive difference, like instantaneous. Like, if it's important, I don't say, do you disagree? I say, do you disagree? I don't say, is this a good idea? Is this a ridiculous idea? I don't say, you know, what? I'm never going for yes. I'm always going for no. And, you know, if I can, because I know I'm all over the place here. I'm on a plane from JFK to L.A., where it's a red eye, and a black businessman sitting next to me. He's kind of loud. He's got a big colorful sweater on. But I just, you know, not crazy out there. But I just think, you know, interesting cat. Clearly a businessman. He's got people on his team because people that are sitting, you know, back in economy are walking by and they're, you know, hey boss, how you doing? And finally, but I hear him on the phone. And he's just trying to force people to say yes. And finally, I can't take it anymore in between calls. And I tap him on the shoulder. And I said, look, get him to say no. Change your questions. You drive me crazy. I can't take it anymore. I'm hearing you shove this down people's throats. Switch from yes to no. And I go, instead of do you agree, do you disagree? Instead of would you do this, are you against doing this? And I give him a quick rundown of how to make the switch. And he's a smart dude, picks it right up really fast. So he gets back on the phone. And I also say, you know, the reason you should listen to me is because I wrote this book, Never Split the Difference. So just do it. Smart dude, learnable, coachable, does it instantaneous. Looks back at me, says, thanks. Yeah. He says, let me introduce myself. My name's Trevor. You may know me by my stage name, Busta Rhymes. And I'm like, wow. Okay. You know, your hair's a little shorter right now. I didn't recognize you right off the bat, but I do recognize that name.
You go on to say, no has a lot of skills. No allows real issues to be brought forth. No protects people from making and lets them correct ineffective decisions. No slows things down so people can freely embrace their decisions and their agreements they enter into. No helps people feel safe, secure, emotionally comfortable, and in control of all their decisions. No moves everyone's efforts forward. And there's a thing that you point out here which is important. Because you say, using this chapter's tools in daily life is difficult for many people because they go directly against one of society's biggest social dictums, that is, be nice, right? Especially because in the book, you're like, hey, smile, be pleasant, and you know, getting people to say no is one of those things. You say, we've instrumentalized niceness in a way as a way of greasing the social wheels, yet it's often a ruse. We're polite and we don't disagree to get through daily existence with the least degree of friction. But by turning niceness into a lubricant, we've leached it of meaning. A smile and a nod might signify, get me out of here, as much as it means nice to meet you. That's death for a good negotiator who gains their power by understanding their counterpart's situation and extracting information about their counterpart's desires and needs. Extracting that information means getting the other party to feel safe and in control. And while it may sound contradictory, the way to get there is by getting the other party to disagree, to draw their own boundaries, to define their desires as a function of what they do not want. In other words, getting them to say no.
Yeah, it's nuts. it's of the you know, the different skills are counterintuitive to their own degree. Like, the extremely strong degree that getting somebody to say yes makes them uncomfortable, concerned, worried about what kind of traps are walking into. Where's a hook? What have I forgotten? Complete different 180 degree turn on getting them to say no. Like the comfort level from saying no, and then the ability to think things through immediately. Like if I were to say to you, disagree, do you disagree? You go, no, I don't disagree, but here are the following problems. And you'd lay them right out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right off the top of your head, have no problem. If I'd have said, do you agree? And you'd have wanted to say, yes, I agree, but here are the following problems. You won't do it the second way, because you would have felt that the mere utterance of the word yes hooked you. And so then anything that you lay out after that feels like you're digging yourself in deeper. But having said no, you don't feel hooked. So now you're going to lay out the next 4 or 5 things that you might need, because you don't feel like you're digging yourself in deeper. And the next 4 or 5 things after the yes or no are what's critical. It's never right there. It's never at the point of decision. It's really, here are the problems, or here's what you got to accomplish. And you got to get past that. And you get past it freely when people say no, because they feel safe and protected. They feel no sense of obligation. They don't feel like they're digging themselves in with each thing they say after that.
I got that emotion from that. You got an example in the book, real common example. The two examples, is now a bad time to talk,
right?
Versus, do you have a few minutes to talk?
Right.
Like when someone calls you up on the phone and says, hey, do you have a few minutes to talk right now? I want to say no, but I also kind of feel like when I say yes, like, what do we get? But when someone says, hey, is it a bad time to talk right now? I'm like, no, it's not a bad time. I'm like, okay with it. It's just one of those things. The other thing that you got in here that really aligns a lot with what I talk about a lot is negotiate in their world. Persuasion is not about how bright or smooth you or forceful you are. It's about the other party convincing themselves that the solution you want is their own idea. So don't beat them with logic or brute force. Ask them questions that open past your goals. It's not about you. I say all the time, written in these books, make it their idea, right? How can I make this their idea?
Yep.
And the other thing I say a lot is, the truth doesn't matter if I punch you in the face with it, right? I mean, if I punch you in the face with the truth, you're not going to be open to it. Right. You're going to be pissed. And you're going to find a way to defend yourself, and you're probably going to stab me in the neck with your facts from your perspective. So,
with a dull spoon, right? Stab you in the neck with a dull spoon.
Yeah.
I was digging through a bunch of my archives, and in there I find, Chris, one of my early mentors, Brian Tracy, the 21 closes to get the yes. And it's the standard yes at close that I felt like that was like just, that's how I was raised as a salesperson. Get the yes, get the yes, get the yes, get the yes. Are you wearing a shirt? Yes. Are you wearing a microphone? Yes. We should do business together. Yes. Right. Like that silly pattern. And the first time I heard you, you talked about, it's not about the yes, it's about the no. I have used that nonstop since. Can you educate the listener that doesn't know what I'm really talking about here? Like give them the little backstory and then share the 4 questions that you want to get the no.
Yeah, well, excuse me. I think there was probably a point in time when the yes momentum, a yesable proposition.
Right.
There was probably a point in time when that was a good idea.
Yeah.
And then it became so effective that people were using it for everything. And then unfortunately, then also people that we can't trust learn to use it to negotiate, you know, all kind of bad deals. There are industries out there that are just freaking famous for just exploiting people to the point of financial ruin.
Right.
So then the problem is it's been used so much and so globally that people are, yes, battered. Like everybody over the age of 19 years old has been bamboozled by the yes momentum, you know, momentum selling.
Yeah.
Because it was so taught so pervasively, and it was at one point in time, I'm willing to concede, there was probably a point in time when it was effective. But now when people are yes battered, They don't know what it is, but they got a gut instinct memory in their bones that they've got bamboozled. You know, what's the phrase? Once you're bitten by a snake, you're afraid of ropes.
Right.
Like you're afraid of everything that even comes close to resembling it. So you as a real estate agent, you as a business person, you as a trusted colleague even, the minute you start trying to get people to say yes, it triggers an overdose from the person that hurt them. Even if they like you, even if they know you, you can't get past the fact that they're yes battered. You know, a grown-up tries to give a hug to a battered child.
Yep.
Because you know that hugs, they're actually something, people are healthier if they get hugged regularly. You're actually healthier.
Correct.
But you try to hug a battered child, they're going to flinch because the last adult that tried to hug them beat them. So your intention is not good enough here. And it's so bad that we've just found like, look, you got to get out of yes entirely. And as simple as it is, as ridiculous as it is, all you got to do is change your yes-oriented question to a no-oriented question. Are you against? Is it ridiculous?
Yeah.
Does it seem like a bad idea? Do you disagree?
Would it be unreasonable?
Like, obviously. Would it be unreasonable?
Right.
And the trigger of the no, because while people have been conditioned that yes is a trap, they've also been conditioned that every time they say no, they protect themselves. Like, again, I'll refer to my son, Brandon, who's a genius negotiator. When he was 17 and it was dad, can I? And I'd say no before he even finished the sentence. But I look back on it and I realize that having said no and I felt protected, I was then more willing to listen. And I would almost invariably turn around with, all right, so what was it that you wanted? Now, having said no, I feel protected and now I'm more open-minded.
No, let me process
it. Right. But Chris, would it be unreasonable for you to tell the story about how you almost killed Jack Welch?
Why no? Somehow I feel compelled to say no. I don't know what it is. Something mystical and magical just came over me because I said no. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm in LA a number of years ago. I'm still teaching at USC, University of Southern California. And Jack Welch, a book signing in LA. You know, I'm going through the long line of people signing the books. And so what does that mean? By the time you get up to Jack, they're doing everything they can do to keep you from talking to them. Because they got 300 people to get through the line. You stand there and chat for 5 minutes, everybody's there for 6 hours. So there's a million reasons why they don't want you talking to Jack. Now, I'm going to pitch Jack. And I know I've got the opportunity to say one thing. Period. I can't even introduce myself. I can't do anything. I got time for one sentence. So, you know, I know the magic of getting a no. So I walk up to him, I look him in the eye and I go, is it a ridiculous idea for you to come and speak at the negotiation course that I teach at USC? And he looks at me and he kind of gets a little bit of a scowl. Then he looks up and to the left and he just gets this hideous scowl on his face. He just freezes. And this was several years ago. Jack Welch, God rest his soul, all my experience with him, genuine, decent human being. And he freezes. And he looks furious. And then he doesn't move. And my first thought is, he's so angry, he had a stroke and he died. And he's going to fall over dead right in front of me. Because he doesn't move. And then, you know, then I think, all right, so he's not dead, but he's furious. And he's going to have him throw me out. But then after what seemed like an eternity, he looks back at me and he says, this is my personal assistant's name. This is a special Twitter account we have set up to communicate with her. I will call her and tell her who you are, what you want. I think we're going to be in Los Angeles in the fall. If we are, we'll come in and speak to your class. So not only did he process a no, but he thought through the next 4 or 5 steps for implementation. And it was done. Boom. It went that quickly.
So I was watching or reading, I forget which one it was. First of all, thank you for telling that story, because I probably listened to it 3 times, and every time I listened to it, I could see Jack's face just like right in that moment, and probably his wife next to him like, you're killing my husband. What the hell is going on here? It's a great example, though. So many of our clients deal with these situations where they need to ask a better question, right? Something that no one else is asking. Everybody's saying like, hey, would you like to know the new value of your house? Everybody's saying, hey, if I can get you a price, would you be willing to X, right? Like everybody's doing that over and over again. And if you're out there and you're listening, you're doing that and you're getting terrific results, just fast forward on this audio message. Otherwise, listen up. You once said, I want to say there was like four different openings, I think it was, to the no question. Is it ridiculous? Would it be unreasonable? Is that the pattern? Or were there four specific questions?
Well, I think there's probably about three or four. If I may, I'll put in an ad for our YouTube channel because I know I've got a video up. The top four no-oriented questions.
That's what it was.
Where I kind of walk through it and what they are and what's behind them. And the other thing to do also is if you just write down, are you against?
Yeah.
You disagree? Would it be ridiculous? And then you while you're writing, you're going to think, well, could I say it this way? As long as you're intentionally attempting to trigger a no.
Yes.
You will begin to figure out other great ways of putting it. Now, some of them are context driven. One of the key ones, which is for restarting conversations with people who have stopped talking with you, is have you given up on working with me?
Love
have you
one.
Given up on Love X, it. Y, or Z? Now, we find like not only will the other person respond, but in a ridiculously short period of time. Like that has the highest compliance rate of anything and quick. Like as a general rule, like when I send that questions, if I'm sending a text, I know that they're going to see a text right away. Have you given up on the project with the Black Swan Group? I'm going to sit there and wait because they're going to answer within 3 to 5 minutes. Now, context, situation drives strategy. If this is your opening line, then that question is probably out of context.
Good point.
Right. And that's a great way for that great question to now create dissonance in me and erode trust. So when I get an opening email, and I know how effective this email is, like, have you given up on taking me on as an intern? Or have you given up on looking at my website? When I've never gone with these people and I have never started, I either delete that email,
right,
or occasionally I'll respond because I suspect that it's somebody I can't trust and they will let me know in their very next response. They'll confirm to me that I can't trust them, that they're trying to take advantage of me.
Yeah.
And that one is so effective that the people that you can't trust have picked up on it. And they're looking for mechanisms, not because they're trying to work with you. They're looking for the hacks to take you to the cleaners. So if you get that question out of context, wait a minute, I never started with you. How could I have given up?
Yeah.
It's a bad sign.
Yeah.
Chris, I'm sitting there thinking, you ever mess with cold callers when they call you? Could you imagine calling Chris as a cold call?
I will tell you, everybody on my team, when we get hit with a bad cold calling script,
right,
we'll take a if we got time on our hands. I realize that some poor schmuck's probably just starting out. It's a tough job. They're just doing what the boss told them to do. We'll try to correct them. I'll jump in and we'll be looking to give a short tutorial.
This is your lucky day. You're going to get educated.
We could tell that, you could tell from the tone of voice, was some kid starting out, somebody trying to make a house payment, somebody in a bad place, and they were just taking whatever work they could get.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, I'm gonna give this guy a break. They probably won't hear me now, but I'm gonna say something that'll get them to reflect back. So if they're learners, when they move on, then they could get better.
It's so funny you say that. Shout out to Hanan Levine, if you're listening right now, from Orange County, California, who, get this, Chris, he cold calls me at my house. He's working for some silly company. I don't know. It was not in the real estate business. And he was so smooth, so authentic, so humble that I was like, tell me more. Like, what? And then I remember, like, 5 minutes into the conversation, literally 5 minutes in, a cold call. I'm a busy guy. And I'm like, this guy is so good. I'm like, where do you work? Like, he's like, you know, I told you the company. I said, no. Where do you live? He's like, oh, I'm in, like, Fullerton. I'm like, listen to me. I don't know what you get paid, but I'm willing to bet I would pay you more. I recruited the guy. He worked for me for 5 years, crushed it with me, then went into real estate and killed it. So I love that. I love that you would actually take the time. I know everybody's busy, but if you actually took the time to help that person, like, that makes my heart sing.
Yeah, you know, and the word that you used to describe him, which I'm sure is one of the main reasons why you went on, you said the guy was authentic.
Yeah.
Authentic.
Yeah. And he was, you know, European accent, European, like, so he didn't come across, like, I know a lot of Euros that, you know, Germans, Austrians, right? Like, super intense. And he is, but he was just like, I'm just, you know, letting you know, I'm calling people in your area and I'm not telling you that everybody is signing up for it. I'm just letting you know if this is something you'd be interested in. It was like, and that wasn't even the script, but it was just so genuine, right? It didn't sound salesy at all, which is why I was so engaged with the guy. But let's go a different direction. I want to make sure. So
one of the other things that you learn a lot in sales trainings, I've been in a number of them that talk about this, is you want to get somebody to say yes. And the more times you can get them to say yes, the more likely they're going to agree to something. And you're right. Completely the opposite. You're looking for people to say no. So can you kind of explain why you would want people to say no to you and what's going on in that situation?
Yeah, well, you know, the problem with this the yes momentum or momentum selling is nearly everybody, as you learned it, including the people that are given bad deals, exploiting people, hurting people with yes. I think at some point in time, every human being is susceptible to this. Very few of us haven't had a time when we've been stung by it. As a matter of fact, I would contend everybody's been stung by this once. I still got in my desk a coupon book that I bought in my early 20s for $25. It was supposed to give me $25,000 in discounts. I couldn't figure out how to use any of those coupons. I still got the coupon book. I look back on it as like, would you like to have a discount on stuff that you buy every day? You know, would you like to give 25% off on your next major purchase? You know, they hit me with three yeses. I'm like, yeah. And then I got stung. It's being yes battered. It's one of the reasons why there are three kind of yeses: confirmation, commitment, and counterfeit. Because people have been stung so many times by this yes momentum nonsense that they've gotten used to giving a counterfeit yes just to try to feel the other side out. So you eliminate this because if you're dealing with somebody who's been yes battered, then the minute you try to get them to say yes, you trigger an instinctive memory in them of the person that cheated them. And you're now engaging in behavior in a person that cheated them, which is a guaranteed erosion of the relationship. Getting out of yes entirely is the first move. And then the crazy thing is, every human being on earth has been taught whenever they say no, not when they hear no. That's a big difference. The difference between saying it and hearing it. What happens when you say no? You protected yourself from harm. There was some unknown harm out there. There was some unknown trap, some unknown hook. When you said no, you protected yourself.
And you're feeling control as well a little bit. You know, exactly. You almost feel as though like, okay, I'm in control of this situation.
Yeah. So what kind of a feeling do I want to foster in you for us to collaborate? I want you to feel safe and in control. Every time I get you to say no, you feel safe and in control. You're more likely to listen to me. You're less likely to have your guard up. You're more likely to tell me the actual obstacles. So instead of saying, like, does this look like a good deal to you? I'll say, does this look like a bad deal? Now, if I say, does this look like a good deal and you need more stuff to make the deal, I'm going to want you to say, yes, it looks like a good deal, but here's what I need. But because you're yes battered, you won't say that at all. But if I say, does this look like a bad deal? You'll say, no, it's not a bad deal, but here's what I need. And bang, you just outlined to me what you need to make the deal. Now I know either we can make it or not, but I triggered it by getting you to say no.
And then when you flip that around, you also talk about if somebody then does say yes,
right,
is this sort of rule of three where you kind of ask them to clarify that statement so it's not a counterfeit yes, that are actually, right, you're really checking that. So what just talk me through that in a bit more detail.
Well, if you say yes, I'll probably actually go yes, and you go yeah. That's a mirror. It's designed to trigger you to elaborate, to let you know that I heard you. I put an upward inflection in it just to say, I want to make sure, clarification. Now, you may just come back with yes again, which is entirely possible because I've gotten you to repeat the yes. Now, I'm trying to get you to repeat more than the yes. I really need the more. And the mirror is the first tool that I'm going to use. So if I don't get any more out of you, I'll hit you with a label. So it seems like this is a good deal for you. Just an observational statement, label design to get more. You're probably going to say a couple more words and add, yeah, it's a good deal for me. Now I'm going to start hearing some tone of your voice because I need to know if there are reservations. The last thing I'm going to do, if you've given me two solid yeses, I'm going to say, okay, so we've talked about this up to now. I'm going to basically paraphrase what we just said. You know, I said this. You said, yeah, I asked you a couple times if this was a good deal and it's worked for you. You responded positively both times. We are free to proceed. Now, even if you're still giving me the counterfeit, I've now created a moment in time where I really drilled in on the yes, not in a manipulative way, but giving you the feeling like you can get out of this if you want to, which preserves your autonomy, which actually increases your likelihood of doing it. It also puts me in a position where if you don't perform, I say, look, last Thursday at 12 o'clock noon, I asked you three times if this worked for you. And three times you told me it did. Now that it's not working, when you told me three times that it did, what did you want me to hear? Leaves me in a perfect position to deal with this if it goes bad.
All right. And following on from that, then, if someone says you're right, you don't want them to say, yeah, you're right, Chris. You want them to say that's right. What happens? What's the difference between you're right, Chris, and yeah, that's right?
Yeah, this is another one of those when, you know, whether we're hearing it or whether we're saying it, two different worlds. Like, we love to hear you're right. Makes us happy. We get satisfied. What happens when we hear it and we hear you're right, we get satisfied, we get a big happy smile on our face and we stop talking because we're right. What are you doing when you're saying you're right? Colleague, family member, significant other, somebody you either want to or have to preserve the relationship with, who will just not leave you alone on something you have no intention of going along with. You look them in the eye and you go, you're right. And they shut up and they stop talking. There ain't a human being on earth that is not using this device to get somebody to shut up. Yet we don't imagine that if we use it to get people to shut up and leave us alone, that someone would do it to us. In fact, we probably did it three times this week. We probably had it done to us three times this week. You're in so much trouble if somebody looks at you and says, you're right. Because they're politely asking you to shut up. Now, the 2-millimeter shift, if that's right, is what somebody says when you have demonstrated to them that you get it, that you get them. And it's this involuntary change in the response. When someone says something to you that you completely agree with, and that them uttering it either gave you an insight or made you feel relieved because of an internal pressure, you go, that's right. That's what people say when they're all in on what they just heard. And the crazy thing about that is it's a bonding moment. They mm-hmm. bond to you. And it's an epiphany moment, which triggers action in favor of you. And that's why so many people that learn the Black Swan method, all they do is get that that's rights out of the other side, and the other side gives them their deal. And how often does it happen? How often does it have to happen?
We look at this as basically it's a bear trap at the end of that rainbow if you're on the yes path. And so what's our alternative? Our alternative is knowing to questions. All of you that have read the book have seen this. You have some feel for it. And so real quick, I'm going to share a short story with you. Some of you may have even heard this on Chris's keynotes about dealing with Jack Welch. So Jack's in LA several years ago. While Chris is living in the area, he and I at the time were actually teaching a negotiation course at the Marshall School of Business at USC for the graduate program. He goes to a book signing to see Jack. Oh, and if you don't know who Jack Welch is, obviously he's an author. We're talking about Chris going to a book signing to get an author from him. But he was a huge businessman. He's not with us anymore, but he ran GE in the 80s and 90s, turned it into one of the fastest growing companies in the United States. He was actually named manager of the century in 1999, which I don't know if there's a higher accolade than that. And he developed this rank and yank system at GE and was also adopted in many other places in the corporate world, which essentially means you don't hit certain standards, you're gone. There is no second chance. You got a standard to meet. You don't get there, we're going to roll you out and bring in somebody that can get the job done. So very big guy, philanthropist, author. A lot of people look up to him and follow his doctrines as a businessman, even still today. So Chris is at this signing. He wants to see if Jack will come teach at his class at USC. Now, if you know anything about book signings, you got about 5 seconds with the author. Security's job is to keep people moving through. Chris doesn't have time to have a full conversation with Jack, do an accusations audit, do a summary, label and mirror his responses. He doesn't have time to do any of that. He's got to do a quick hitter, and it's got to be emotionally intelligent, and he's got to do it now. And so he walks up to Jack. And if you've heard the story, you know that he says, is it ridiculous for you to come speak at my class at USC? And as the story goes, Jack gets a very intense look on his face, looks up and to the left and just kind of freezes with this very angry look. In that moment, Chris thinks to himself, I just killed Jack Welch. He's an old guy, and he's so angry at my question that he's actually having a stroke in front of me, and he's going to drop dead, and security's going to drag me out of here by my ankles, and I'm going to jail. And after about 10 seconds of this intense look, Jack looks back at Chris, and he says, here's a Twitter handle that's private that only people use internally in my company. My assistant actually runs this as me. I'm going to let her know that you're going to reach out to her through this Twitter handle so that we can keep in touch. And I think we're supposed to be back in LA in the fall. This is sometime in the spring of that year. He says, if we're back in LA at that time frame, I will come speak at your class at USC. Now, the long of it is Jack wasn't, in fact, back in the fall. Very busy guy, couldn't make it, so it didn't happen. However, he got the commitment in the moment. Why is that? Obviously, the no-oriented question. But what happened? What happened in Jack Welch's brain in that moment that made it so easy for him to answer? And the crazy thing about no-oriented questions, and I wish we could point to a specific brain science study that lays this out. Maybe there will be soon, right, with fMRI machines and this wonderful technology and being able to plug electrodes into people's brains. I'm sure there'll be a study at some point that explains how this works. What we've observed as negotiators, as content experts, as former hostage and crisis negotiators, when you allow someone to say no to you. And in fact, when you aim at someone saying no to you, it clears their thought process. As a lot of you have thrown into the chat, some of the problems with yes, because yes makes people nervous, the instant reaction is, how do I defend myself in this moment? And that clutters up the brain. It doesn't allow us to be cognitively flexible when we're worried about how we have to defend ourselves. And so he confronted Jack over a very specific want, did it without a confrontational reaction, and cleared Jack's thought process to lay out the implementation of how it would work, all at the same time with a very simple question. And so you can take our word for it, or you can do what we're going to implore you to do as a result of this class and our next two. Go out and start executing this stuff if you're not already. If you are executing this stuff already, then you should start developing your go-to list. If you listen to anything we've talked about before, you know we talk a lot about go-to labels. The reality is, when the heat is on, you fall to your highest level of preparation. And as a result of that, we like to have go-to lists of every single skill that we talk about. And we keep that stuff near to us, right? Laminate it, put it in your jacket pocket, make a list, put it on your desk.
The way that why questions are accusatory, mm-hmm. but how questions invite people to do the thinking for you and explain that, like the, explain the power of how.
Yeah, to use Kahneman's phraseology, it triggers slow thinking or in-depth thinking.
You know, because it's logistical?
Yeah. You know, how largely is implementation or logistical? Is another, how's this going to get done? It feels deferential.
So I'm going to kill these motherfuckers if you don't give me $20 million right now. And you say,
how am I supposed to do that?
Go to the bank. Call the president. Do whatever you need to do. This is somebody's life. Give me the $20 million right now.
How am I supposed to do that right now? You want me to call the president? You want me to go to the bank?
Do they not just keep screaming? Yes, that's exactly what I want you to do.
All they got to do is come down a little at a time. Now, I'm not resisting. I'm in implementation. And it triggers in-depth thinking. And in point of fact, those are legitimate questions. You know, the ask a question that whether the other side likes it or not is actually a legitimate question. Not resisting. I'm asking in a way where I'm deferential. I'm not saying I ain't doing it. I'm asking for your help. Now, how you respond to that is going to tell me where this is really going. You know, there's a 93% success rate means 7% of the time it ain't going to go anywhere. This is nothing but bad. I got to know which one I'm dealing with. And so, you know, my how and what questions early on, and occasional the strategical use of why, surgical use of why, I got to diagnose what I'm really dealing with. And I got to do it in a way where you're not feeling like you're being diagnosed. But, you know, because I got to do everything I can do to avoid triggering you, but I got to get a diagnostic on what I'm actually dealing with to begin with.
And how do you handle telling people no in a way that doesn't shut them down?
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine here in town, Ned Colletti, used to be the GM for the Dodgers. Brilliant negotiator. Good guy. Like him a lot. Ned is still around. Still affiliated with the Dodgers. First year he was GM, they went from worst to first. That's a sign of a capable GM. Okay. You know, and we were talking about this one time, and Ned said that someone had taught him to let out no a little at a time. And I'm like, that's exactly what we're doing. Like, you have to be able to say no to people. What your job is to not let them get blindsided by it, where they feel like they were clotheslined and caught off guard. So you let it out a little at a time. And how am I supposed to do that is really a way to get the other side thinking about the difficulty of the situation, about the difficulty of the ask. And it's the first way to start letting know out.
Why can't you just say that's really going to be hard?
Further down the line, we're going to get there. But first, I really kind of need the how question is designed to get stop you in your tracks and get you thinking. It's calibrated, which is why we call them calibrated questions, to start to trigger a state change in the other side. Now, we got to let out a little more no in a little firmer way as we go along. Then we got a whole succession of ways to eventually, ultimately, if forced into it, to say no. Which then also is not no. It's no. But we don't need to go. Like if you hear no from me or my side, we've been hinting at it for a while. So you're not going to be feel blindsided. And we're going to continue to demonstrate collaboration because I don't want to go all the way to now. If we're talking, there's a reason for us to talk. The adversary is the situation. So if there's a reason for us to collaborate and talk where we can both be better off, I also don't want to let out no too quickly because there might be a better way and I want to discover that. So let me start telegraphing that there are problems here, inviting collaboration. See if we can tease out a solution before this thing goes down the tubes.
Have you ever had a negotiator or a hostage taker give you an answer to something that you were like, I actually don't have a rebuttal to that. We should try that.
Not yet.
Yeah, I'm running these scenarios through my head and I'm like, what would I do if they like offered a suggestion? I'm like, yeah, like actually sounds, maybe we should try that. Like, how do you, because there are scenarios where you end up paying apparently $20 million.
Well, we first of all, it wasn't the U.S. that paid that or anybody on the U.S. side.
So the U.S. would never do that?
Correct. The U.S. does not pay ransom. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be bait money go downrange.
Meaning because you give them money that you know you're going to take back?
Or you're going to trace. Like money is ridiculously easy to trace. Like ridiculously easy. And it could be a very smart move. It's like injecting dye into their financial circulatory system. Mm. Where are they buying weapons? Who are they paying safe houses for? They got a larger criminal network. Terrorists are not supported by the Red Cross. They're supported by a larger criminal network of illegal arms dealers and illegal this and illegal that. And you want to know who they're buying their guns from. And the best way to find out who they're buying their guns from is to give them some money that you could trace and find out where it goes. Follow the money, as they said a long time ago in the Watergate scandal. That's a tremendous investigative tool. And if there was in 2000, that was exactly what happened because there was a criminal gang out of Ecuador that had been taking hostages on oil platforms every year at about October. And they were a combination of former terrorists and criminals. And so the third time it went down, a payment was made because if they'd assaulted the oil platform, they'd only got the kidnappers, who were the lower end of the food chain. But they made a payment, and they ended up dismantling the gang in its entirety, and they never hit again. Oh. Over 50 people were rounded up.
Because they were tracking the money.
Tracking the money. The whole organization was dismantled as a result of the ransom payment. So it became a great way to take out a criminal organization that had been operating completely freely prior to that. And a rescue would have only taken out the bad guys on a platform. It would not have taken out the whole organization. They took the whole thing down, and these guys never resurfaced as an organization again.
So going back to the magic words that you use as a negotiator, why is getting them to say no more important or better, much better, if I remember your words correctly,
yeah,
than yes?
Yeah, it's shocking. And a friend of mine that I'm flattered that we're acquainted, Andrew Huberman, Huberman Labs podcast.
Know him well. Amazing guy.
Brilliant neuroscience stuff. Met him for the first time recently. We're sitting down at lunch, and I'm like, all right, so I don't know what the neuroscience behind this is, but people feel safe and protected when they say no. they feel better. They're more likely to collaborate. And plus what we
that's
know.
That's so weird.
What, the other thing that's crazy that we know for sure is, like, when you're exhausted mentally, you could still say no.
But yes is hard.
Yes is hard, or even as answering how. Like, if you're tired, and one of my colleagues did this to me recently, and I could instantly tell the difference. They wanted to follow up with me when I was exhausted, and I knew that if they'd asked me, what are you thinking? What? Great question. Triggered deep thinking. I didn't have the mental gas in the tank to answer that question. But they answered me a question that was built around no, and I went boom, 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 boom. I laid it all out. And I was like, wow. I don't know how that happens. I just know it does. And we've seen time after time, if I need to close a deal at all, especially if I know that you're tired, instead of saying, do you agree? Do you want to do this? Are you in favor of this? I say, do you disagree? Is this a bad idea? Are you against this? Is this ridiculous? And you'll either go, no, let's do it. Or you go, no, but here are the problems. And you'll lay them all out for me. And feel no obligation, which means you're going to lay them out to me honestly. Like if I say, do you agree with this? You're going to afraid to say yes, but here are the problems because you feel that yes is an obligation. And you're going to be worried about digging yourself deeper in by saying anything after that. But having said no, you feel you have no obligation.
I think it might be that simple.
So you will lay the rest of the stuff out, not being worried about digging yourself into a hole.
It's really interesting that some part of our brain is tracking the, even though it's not like obviously a contract, but that some part of our brain is like, yeah, we've just agreed to that. And now I have a sense of obligation and they have the right to like take me to task on it. It's
right.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And we stumbled over that one by accident. And it is just the good and the bad about getting people to say no is it makes such a huge difference in all interactions that sometimes that's the only thing somebody learns. And we're like, look, there is so much more here. Like, I know you're making a lot more money now. And you're doing better than anybody that you see around you. But you're not doing as good as you could be doing, and you cannot stop there. But a lot of people, I see it all the time. They just learn how to trigger no instead of yes. And they're instantly, significantly more successful. And they quit there. They don't keep going.
All right. What then, if you were going to bring this all together, if no is that first bit that shows people like, whoa, you can frame this in a new way. What are the few key tenets of like, all right, if you had to bestow quickly upon somebody what the core tenets of the Black Swan way are?
Yeah, you know, let the other side go first. And then, you know, the cliche, the other side's got to talk five times as much as you. Not twice as much, five times as much. It doesn't mean that you go mute. You drop in occasionally. You let the other person know that whatever they're thinking is, it's okay to share it. Like, one of our favorite things, you got to have some go-to labels.
Go-to labels?
Yeah, label is one of our negotiation techniques. Seems like, sounds like, looks like, feels like. No matter what anybody says, you can say, seems like you had a reason for saying that. Like, no matter what they say, I hate you and everything you stand for. Seems like you got a reason for saying that. It's disarming. They'll talk with you about it. I want to do business with you and I want to deal with you right now. Seems like I had a reason for saying that. Well, yeah, here's why I want to do business with you. One of my son came up with, again, like brilliant guy. We would not be our team without him. Clients call on a phone, say, how are you today? How are you today is a diagnostic. They want to know if they could talk, if you're in a mood to talk about what they want to talk about. Brandon's response is, seems like you got something on your mind. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, because they've been planning this call. How are you today is not like genuinely how some people really want to know, but most people want to know, are you prepared to listen to what I have on my mind? How are you is a temperature check. Are you in a bad mood? Because I'm wasting my time. You in a good right. mood? We could talk. And the only pushback he ever got on that was he had a guy say, yeah, you know, there's stuff I want to talk about. Really, I want to know how you are today. And so Brandon said, yeah, I'm good. You know, we talked about it. And then they got down to business. So, you know, the more you encourage the other side to talk, the more likely it is that you're going to get to this moment of collaboration quicker. Never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better. How do you get something better? You get the other side to talk. You spend a lot less time talking and appreciate that they're bringing something to the table that you could use. The black swan, the tiny little thing that's going to change everything. You trigger that, you're going to make great deals.
That's it. We've got our basic principles.
Yeah, my question is, it's about saying no. So actually, I read one of your blogs, Communication Skills, the Three Ways to Make No for You. So what would be the best piece of advice you could give someone like me who finds it hard to say no sometimes? And how can I build my confidence by saying no during the right time? So, yeah, that's my question. Thanks so much.
Yeah, well, great question. I mean, they're kind of like, so like any word, there's two aspects. You know, if you're saying it and if you're hearing it. But in every negotiator's life, there's a turning point. The biggest turning point is probably coming to grips with the words yes and no. And I 1,000%, I remember the moment. It's about 2002. I'm walking to an airport, and I'm always looking at the bookshelves, and I see a book on a bookshelf that says start with no. And I literally do a double take. Stop me in my tracks. Like, start with no in a business negotiating section? This is nuts. I got to look at this book. And it was Jim Camp's book on, and he wasn't really trying to get people to say no, but it was about you being okay with hearing it. And then you being okay with letting the other side know it's cool to say no. And his whole approach, he called it the right to veto. He said at the beginning of the negotiation, say to the other side, it's okay, you can say no to me at any time. Say no, and this is over. You're free to say no whenever. And then Camp writes in his book that people will die to preserve their autonomy. And when you take away their right to say no, you take away their autonomy, and they'll die to preserve it. And I remember thinking, like, no shit. We learned that in hostage negotiation a long time ago. That's why we got hostage negotiators. Because people are getting killed right and left over losing their autonomy over their home. So coming to grips with yes and no will move you forward as a communicator. Now, hearing it and saying it. My buddy in L.A., Ned Colletti, former GM of the Dodgers, great guy, good human being. I borrow this phrase from him. He said, I like to let out no a little at a time. Don't let the other side be shocked with the word no. You know, how can you begin to hint that there's a no coming if they don't watch it? You know, I start that out in the book. I wrote the book, Never Split the Difference, with my son, Brandon, and Tal Raz. Brandon is uncredited co-author. We start with the number one way to let out no a little at a time, which is, how am I supposed to do that? The other side's reaction gives you a clear picture of who you're dealing with and how collaborative they're going to be. You're not saying that to get an answer from them. You're saying that to begin to warn them that no is on its way. I never want anybody to be shocked when I flat out say no. I'll start out by saying, how am I supposed to do that? One time in 10, they're going to come back and say, that's up to you to figure out. If you want the deal, you got to do it my way. One time in 10. When that one time in 10 comes, my answer is, I'm sorry. You've been very generous. That just doesn't work for me. That's a little stronger way to say no. That hits a couple of more emotional levers from the other side. If I say, if a black swan says to you, I'm sorry, there's bad news on the way and we are warning you. We never let you get hit with bad news and then say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry is our precursor to us taking a stronger position and giving you a chance to brace yourself for hearing a tougher,
drawing of a line, you know, a stronger boundary. I don't want you to run into the boundary and be shocked by it. I'm going to warn you it's coming. After I've warned you a couple times, if I need to say no, then I'm going to say no. And then I'm going to say, I look forward to the day when we work this out, because my intention from the beginning was for us to have a great long-term relationship. And when we're prepared to make mutually beneficial commitments, we can continue this conversation. And then it's peace out from my side. Now, no from the other side. You feel safe when you say no. You feel protected. If you feel safe and protected, you're more likely to collaborate with me freely because you feel safe and protected. So I'm going to say what we were talking about before earlier with Brianne. Have you given up on whatever it is? Do you disagree? Are you against? Is this a ridiculous idea? If I'm worried that you might react negatively, I just opened a very emotional negotiation tonight within my family on some very emotional issues in reference to my mother's recent passing. And I don't want anybody to feel like I'm intruding on their feelings or their autonomy. So I started out with, are you opposed to me wanting this? Because I want to know if they're opposed, and I want them to not feel guilty over their emotional feelings. So the best way for me to start that out is to start it out in that fashion. And that negotiation, which is meant to be collaborative in nature with nobody losing, has started out well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Thanks so much for that answer.
Hi, Chris. Chris, it was great meeting
Charles,
you.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It was great meeting you the other week, and I loved your story about meeting Jack Welch and asking him to come speak at your class, I believe it was at SC, by framing it in a no question. I want you to know I've been using that with my girlfriend. I've been using the would it be ridiculous or would I be out of line if I asked for this? And I wanted to know if you had any other good no questions to ask that are really yes questions.
You know, I don't, all of them. I mean, I don't ask any yes questions. I just know that people, it works better, it hits the brain better. So, you know, is now a bad time to talk? Is it a ridiculous idea? Have you given up on? Is it a bad idea? Are you opposed? Do you disagree? I mean, with the slightest amount of practice, you could switch any yes question into a no question, and it just works. It works better across the board. I mean, nobody in my company asks yes questions. Nobody asks, have you got a few minutes to talk? Nobody says, do you agree? It just, across the board, it makes it safer for people to answer. And also, the real issue always is, if there are problems, I want you to feel free to tell me what the problems are. And you're going to feel free to tell me those problems after no. So, with just a little bit of practice, and it takes practice. You know, all of these are, you know, get your practice reps in the low stakes conversations, and pretty soon the stuff starts flowing out of your mouth. A couple of weeks ago, I'm making a pitch in a hotel for a room upgrade, and I don't got any room upgrades, but I've worked so much on no oriented questions. And because, like, I am pushing this guy hard for something extra that I'm not paying for. And finally, I says, well, is it ridiculous for you to make it up for me at the bar? And he's like, no. And he goes and gets a bunch of free drink coupons for the bar. So, you know, no oriented questions is a great one to practice. You'll find it'll bail you out when you're trying to get free drinks.
We get so hung up. Because at the end of the day, what was Chris telling you? Each of the role players, what was he telling you? No, right? He was telling you no. It was in a different form, car in 60 seconds or she dies. But he was telling you no. Anytime somebody tells you no, they're telling you what? What's behind the no? When somebody gives you pushback, when somebody says do this or else, cut your price, I'm going to a competitor, take this clause out of the contract or we're not going to sign. Change your delivery date. Give me a raise or I'm going to another company. What are they really telling you?
Now we got a hand back here.
Yes, but they're pushing back. Why are they pushing back? What are they telling you with the pushback? No. They don't trust you or they're afraid of something. We get so wrapped around the axle on the demand. I want a car in 60 seconds. What's behind that? What is he telling you? I want to get out of here. Which tells you what? Which tells you what? He wants to get out. He's afraid. Go deeper, as they say, as Brandon says, go deeper.
Hey, Isaac's the one that gives you crap over that, not me.
I'm hearing a lot of things. Say it again.
I say he doesn't have a plan. No, I think you're back here.
He wants to live. He wants
Who said
to
that?
Live.
Raise your hand. That's it. That's exactly it.
There's a motivation behind every pushback, every no. And it usually has to do with trust, usually has to do with fear. There's another motive. When Chechen terrorists marched into that school in 2004 in Beslan, Russia, one of the first two demands on their list was, we want Putin to resign, and we want Russian boots off of Chechen soil. Show of hands, how many think that would ever happen? And so the powers that be said, it's never going to happen. This is non-negotiable. We can't negotiate this. What are they saying behind that? Russian boots off of Chechen soil and Putin has to resign. What are they saying behind it? What? If you carry it
to its die for
willing to die, I'm sorry. Yes, he said they're willing to die for it. If you carry it to its logical extension based on their history, probably. But what is the message behind?
They want freedom.
Yeah. Their sovereignty and freedom has been encroached upon. That's what we're going to talk about. The fact that they said, take it out of the contract or we're not going to sign, I don't care about that. I want to know what makes them say that. Why are they afraid to sign? What is their environment looks like that's clouding their vision? And so don't get hung up on the fact that they've issued a threat or they've issued a demand. You take it, you process it, and then you start to attack what's propping that up, what's supporting it. And at the primal level, it's fear or it's mistrust. Did you want to add? Brandon?
Very good. And yeah, just to kind of add to more of that, how do you get to the why without asking the why? Short answer is labels. And then to go even further than that, labeling the underlying dynamic. Need a car in 60 seconds or she dies? Sounds like you want to live. The circumstance and the situation drive your strategy. When people are barricaded suspects, are they always looking to make it out alive? No. So the fact that they're asking for a car and a way of escape at the beginning is a really good sign. Part of the why that tells you right away is they want to live. Then how do we get to more of the why? Sounds like you got a reason for doing this. Sounds like you got a good reason, a good justified reason for why you got up this morning and decided to take all these people hostage. What he said was, and this should be on your go-to labels list, especially as a last-ditch effort, it sounds like there's nothing I can say to change your mind. And again, mastery's in tonality, but also to his point, as business people, part of our job is qualifying our clients. And so if you know that you're with somebody that is taking that line with you, the other question you should be asking yourself is, do I want to do business with this schmuck for the next 5 years? Or is it actually easier for me to cut my losses and focus my time on something else? It's one of the great things. That's one of the great things about having autonomy as a business person. You get to make that decision. And so if you know you're dealing with someone who is stuck on that one-track mind, you can take the route of, all right, we'll come to an agreement. I don't mind playing the game as long as I know what the rules are. Or you can say, yeah, this is a fucking waste of my time. I've been working with this guy. He clearly seems to recognize some sort of loss, but he's stuck. His pride and ego is too stuck to this number. and he just doesn't have the ability to think this through right now, which happens, because that sounds like you're dealing with an assertive, and assertives are one-track mind people sometimes. They get tunnel vision because they're so focused on a goal, and there ain't nothing that's going to penetrate that thought process until they got a couple of nights to sleep on it. And so how are you, again, emotional moments, right? How are you managing it, and then do you want to do business with that person?